Cultivated Being Podcast.
The Cultivated Being Podcast. That's us. This is the place. Two brothers, doctors, opposite sides of the country, the U.S. We have lots of international listeners, so we got to be specific here.
Yeah, U.S. is a big country, relatively speaking, and we're far away from each other.
Yes.
3,000 plus miles, I guess. I never looked it up. It's too sad.
Yeah, I don't know geography that well. But my name is Dr. Nick Hyde. This is my brother, Dr. Jake Hyde. Jake.
Hello, everybody.
This is our weekly chat where we check in because, first of all, we love each other and we want to talk about stuff. But also, we bring in you listeners. We talk about all kinds of health-related things that you might find interesting as well. And then just all kinds of random stuff. So this is a good place.
And health-related things is a broad brush for me and Nick because we look at life, basically, because that's where your health comes from. We look at the four pillars. We're talking the physical health. We're talking your mental health, your emotional and your spiritual. Feel like a lot of our podcasts start maybe in the physical or mental and they go to like spiritual and emotional. But you know what? That's life, isn't it?
It's all connected. I think, you know, I mean, I say this a lot with my clients, but like, if you separate the spiritual from the physical, it's called death, right?
very good.
You know, we can't do that. It's all connected. And that's why you can, I mean, people know this deep in their bones, man. They know this. There's been times where I'm sure all of you have had an emotional thing or a spiritual thing going on with you and you were feeling it in your body, you know, or vice versa, you know.
Nick, that's actually a good segue to what I really want to talk about today.
Okay.
But I'm not ready. I want to just talk about life for a little bit.
Okay.
See, Nick, I was thinking about it. I already mentioned I missed you on this pod, but it's true. And I really enjoy that every week. I get to see your face through a computer. We get to talk. And I like that it's Fridays because Friday, like after work, is a sacred time. And we probably discussed this on the pod before at some point. But for a while after college, moving back to Phoenix for a bit, Friday after work, myself and our two sisters, we'd head back to our parents and they'd have like food, snacks, and like drinks waiting for us. We'd all kind of reconnect before we like went out, you know, as you do in your early mid-20s. Go back out on a Friday, but like right after work, go to mom and dad's, connect with the family, like catch up on the week. And I love that. You were in college.
I was in college.
You were still a kid, but I still, I just realized that like this is the closest thing I have to that because every Friday after I'm done with work, sometimes you're done with work.
Yeah. No,
you get to connect.
It's an awesome tradition. I mean, and that's just it. Jake and I, for those of you who don't know this, we would do this and we were doing this regardless of the podcast. So this is a cool thing because it comes straight from our hearts to yours. So speaking of, how are things going, man?
Good. Wish you could smell this, but I'm at my office making bone broth currently. I actually have a really nice like, commercial kitchen in my office because we do like cooking demos and like food workshops and stuff like that. So I cook here all the time. It's, you know, it's probably the best kitchen I've ever had personally. And bone broth is a beautiful thing. And I've been an advocate of bone broth as a dietary staple, but I never really made delicious bone broth until more recently. I made it just for like health purposes, and health purposes are numerous.
Well, let's talk about
great fat, great collagen, great protein, great mineral content. You can get really good like vitamins and minerals out of it. And it's already pre-digested. So if you want to give your digestive tract a little break, just sip on some bone broth for a day or a couple days. Your digestive system doesn't have to do any work. The nutrients just already are available.
So is it the slow cooking process, the long cook that kind of pre-digests it, as you're saying?
Exactly. All right. So you get, you know, your animal product from your bones, and you get your, you know, the breakdown of the vegetables that you put in as well. And slowly over time, it just breaks down and it liberates everything into liquid. And then you filter out, you strain it. So it's brothy, and all the nutrients are just ready to go, ready to be absorbed through your gut into your bloodstream.
That's awesome. And I, because of selfish reasons, I mean, there's lots of things we could say about benefits of bone broth right now, but selfish reasons, it sounds like Jake is doing bone broth 2.0, and I want to know how he's, what he's doing to make it delicious.
Oh man, Nick. Okay. Let me tell you, I went away from your traditional, like American, like Thanksgiving stocks type of formula, which I used to do. So you get like your chicken bones, and you get your typical veg, your onion, your carrot, your celeries, and then your herbage. You'd get your like bay leaf, maybe some thyme, maybe some rosemary, obviously salt and pepper. You put it in there, and that's fine.
That's really good. But yeah, it's so Thanksgiving-y.
It's not great. So you have to go to the people that know broth better. And that's the Asians. There's various ways you can go.
I'm excited.
I like to go. My last broth was more ramen-esque in nature, but this one I'm going to make today / tomorrow because I do a full 24 hours. I'm doing more of like a pho type of feel to it.
Yeah.
Which is the Vietnamese variety for those of you out there. And if you haven't enjoyed a bowl of delicious pho, get out there, go to some hole in the wall, like go to some strip mall in your city, go to a Vietnamese place, get yourself a bowl. It's maybe the world's best soup. Personally, I think I like the flavor of ramen more because I like just how extreme ramen is. But when it comes to a broth standpoint, nothing's more, I think, just refined and like beautiful as a good pho broth.
Okay, I'm getting hungry.
And that's spelled pho. If you aren't familiar with that, it looks like it would be pronounced pho.
I said not pronounced that for 2 years before someone corrected me.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. But that's not technically how it's pronounced, I guess. But if you said that to me, I wouldn't correct you.
Yeah,
it's just rude. It's just rude to correct people. something like that. It's not for me to do, but okay. So here's how I'm making it.
Okay.
I got two chunks or two, like 8-inch segments of, grass fed, like pasture raised beef femur.
Whoa.
So marrow intact. Nice. These are frozen, and these were frozen. I got these at Whole Foods. A lot of grocery stores are carrying more bones that you can buy in like freezer section near a butcher shop, or maybe you can even ask your butcher. So a couple of those, then I got some oxtail segments, and this is really important.
Oh, baby.
So you get some oxtail. That's essentially getting spinal bones. And this time I got femur, but last time I did, I got beef spine. Basically like the vertebra, which has a ton of meat and a ton of connective tissue and bone all in one. So you're going to get a lot of goodies from that. And also just some old chicken bones from, I usually cook like whole chickens.
Okay.
I harvest the meat and then I save the bones and I'll just throw that in there. So I had some leftover chicken bones.
How big is this pot you're cooking in?
It's really big. It's like 3 gallons.
Wait, can I see it? Can you like, is it behind you?
It's like all the way across the room. I don't know. Oh, can you see it? Big old metal one. Yeah. Nope. Okay. All right. We tried.
Is it the refrigerator? No.
Yeah. It's some good podcasting right there. Okay. So that's the bone broth portion of it. than the rest of it. And so what I like to do is, this is a very important step. You put your water in, get some high quality water, and then you just cover the bones. You don't need to fill your pot, cover the bones, boil. Within 10, 20 minutes of the boil, all this gnarly looking stuff comes to the top. They call it scum. Technically, no better word for what comes up to the top there. And you skim all that. That's not flavor. That is just like impurities and like stuff you don't necessarily want from your bones.
We are having technical difficulties. Probably something I need to pause and edit out. We'll see if I will.
All right, we just had technical difficulty. I'm sure Nick's going to edit this brilliantly. But I was talking about the scum that comes to the top. You got to skim that off. And if you don't skim it off, like when it initially bubbles to the top, eventually it'll fall back into solution. So make sure, you know, in that first like 10 to 20 minute window. So pay attention initially on that boil, then turn it down. Turn it down to low. And I like to do like the bones alone for 12 hours and then put the veg in for the second 12 hours. If you can do a 24, if you can only do a 12 hour cook, that's fine. Add the veg in after that you skim the scum, but that make sure you do that and then add the veg. 12 hours is still going to be delicious. 24 hours, you just get such a release because you get like all the way through the marrow. You get pretty amazing release of nutrients and so much collagen. So the last broth I made, when it was put in the fridge, it was jello. It was a completely gelatinous state.
Wait, so you're doing this for 24 hours or so. When do you start?
So I start in a pot on the stovetop, like say, like I did today around like 1, and you know, before nighttime or before I leave, then you transfer to like a crock pot, unless you feel comfortable keeping it on like an electric stovetop overnight on low, but crock pot seems like a better idea. And then let it go for, you know, the remainder of time on a low setting. So if you want to start at 1 in the afternoon one day and then it's done by 1 the next day, in that case, I would do the boil. Add the vegetables earlier and then just go to bed, let it cook on low for a while. And then the next day you filter it out. Add it to your mason jars, add it to whatever, and then you can kind of dose out your broth as needed, which you can do to make soups. You can just sip on the bone broth as like a kind of fasting thing if you want to just do a couple days of bone broth fasting. And a bone broth fast is just you consume nothing but this broth for, you know, a few days. I like to recommend 3 if you're serious about it, because your entire digestive tract lining replaces itself every 3 days. So if you have major digestive issues, an extended fast where your GI tract doesn't have to do any work because you're just getting all your nutrients from this broth, a lot of healing can happen in just those 3 days. So I didn't say what veg I add though. I talked about what I put in my bones.
Yeah, we talked about an old one, but you're talking about the pho recipe one.
Yeah. So yeah, so for this one, we're talking 1 white onion. We're talking maybe 3 like good sized celery stalks. A bunch of green onions, which some people call spring onions. I think some people call them chives or big chives. But anyway, probably you know, like whatever you buy at the store, you know, the size that comes in, that's what I put in.
Okay.
Then I put some lemongrass stalks.
Nice.
I put like 3-star anise.
Excellent.
They come like dry form. Mm-hmm. I put a cinnamon stick.
Ooh.
I put, I don't know, 15 peppercorns.
I'm loving this.
And that is it.
Would you put any ginger and garlic in it? You just don't want to put it in.
Oh, sorry. I put garlic in it already. And I would totally put ginger, but I don't have it.
Oh.
But I think in the future, if I'm going to make soup for myself, then I'll add some ginger. Like I'll grate some ginger into it or something. Okay. And I'd like add some fresh cilantro. You can add some fresh things in at the end. Oh. But if I had ginger, I would take they call them like hands of ginger. Just cut it up into some big pieces and put that in right now. If I had it, but I don't.
I gotta say, the Vietnamese and Thai flavors like that are some of my all-time favorite flavors.
I put allspice. I have like whole allspice in there too.
Oh, baby. That's amazing.
It smells really good in my office already. Because I just put the veg in. After this pot, I'm not going to really be around. So I just added the veg now. I just can't wait. And it already smells amazing.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I love the idea of bone broth, but I can't drink it by its own. I just don't like it. I like to have it with stuff. You know, I have to cook a soup in it or whatever. I've had a hard time just sipping on it by itself. But if we put, you know, if we get some of those other kind of flavors, I could totally see me enjoying that because I love that stuff.
Skim the scum, Nick. That's very important. A lot of those off flavors come up with that.
It's good to know. That's cool because I'm a huge fan of extended fasts. I'm a huge fan of that. In fact, this is talking about long-term goals and accountability is really big for me right now. So I'm going to say this to the whole world right now. Anyone who listens to this.
Whoa.
I, at some point, I want to have like a healing retreat center.
Okay.
And part of it is it'll be an awesome place for people to do long-term extended fasts. Kind of like how they do in Russia, where you have people who check in with you and you have options of how to do the extended fast. You have people checking your blood every 2 days or whatever and checking with you to like keep the fat, like extended fast healthy. You know, they do it for 21 days. A lot of them will do it for 21 days and it's kind of like a spa and I do other healing stuff. I'm totally going to do that at some point because I believe in extended fasting so much.
Why do you believe in extended fasting so much?
I think the research is pretty solid. So one thing I like, you know, there's lots of things that can benefit people. I mean, pretty much anything. If you change your life with some positive thing that you weren't doing, your life is going to, you know, obviously you're going to have some improvement.
Right. And that doesn't mean you should always do that in perpetuity for the rest of your life. It's just like that little challenge, that little positive change at that moment in your life can be beneficial.
Totally. What I like about extended fasts is the research shows that the benefits that come with, talking about a challenge, right? The benefits that come from a challenge such as that have a longer lasting effect than most any other thing. Meaning, 2 years after you do an extended fast, your body is still having those same benefits. And they've shown that it's about 90% where people who got any benefit after a year and a half not doing that stuff anymore, they still have that same benefit, 90% of people. That's good quality math, man. And a lot of our research, you know, we're really behind on the Russians because they've just been doing it for a lot longer than us. And of course, we weren't sharing any medical information for a long time with them. But they started doing extended fast research based out of a mental hospital. And one psychologist they kept trying to give this one of their inmates food who was schizophrenic. And they kept trying to, and he wasn't doing it. And so finally the doctor was like, well, let's just see what happens. You know, maybe this schizophrenic has some intuition about themselves. And so they let that happen. And after 21 days, you know, they're checking in, they're doing all kinds of making sure like nothing, there's no medical red flag going on with this person. And after it was like 22 or 23 days, this schizophrenic guy no longer had symptoms of schizophrenia, number one. And number two, he decided he started to want to eat. He was hungry. And so he started eating around that time period, 21, 22, 23 days, something like that. And so all of a sudden he's like not showing any signs or symptoms of schizophrenia. So they ended up releasing him after that. 2 years later, they checked in with him, still no signs of schizophrenia. And this doctor was like, what? And so started to test thousands and thousands and thousands of cases, doing the same kind of thing and, you know, obviously making it more method to it. And I mean, this is an interesting thing. And there's a book that Nick Wignall recommended that was called, I'm going to butcher this, but it was about pharmacology in psychology, you know, how well it works, how well, you know, like all the really common medications you use to treat, you know, different psychoses, how well they work and the study and research behind it. And it is so poorly done. But then you see the top, out of the top 10 prescriptions prescribed right now in America, at least, I think six of them are different psychological drugs like Wellbutrin or, you know,
Xanax,
something. Yeah. So those are all super popular prescribed and the research really bad. So that's actually what got me thinking about that stuff in the first place. And one of the studies that they were referring to in that book happened in the US, and it showed that majority of people, you know, schizophrenia is always kind of the top bar of psychological things because it is a little bit of an umbrella term. Schizophrenia is just like this person has the worst of the worst kind of mental episodes happening to them. And a lot of it is we don't really know the causes of it. And there's lots of factors we don't understand. So schizophrenia is kind of like a term we use for people who have really bad psychological issues happening to them. So, and they discovered that majority of people who weren't prescribed any medication, who were having episodes of schizophrenia, eventually the schizophrenia would go away. So a lot of it would just spontaneously, you know, go away or whatever. And then once we started prescribing people who had schizophrenia, it started staying. I was like, that's really interesting. So the symptoms would get less, but the brain in a sense was kind of incapable of healing from whatever that was. Right.
Wow. Okay. I'm following.
Yeah. And, the book, now that I'm remembering, is called Anatomy of an Epidemic. It's a really good book. Yeah. So I'll post a link to that. That just came up. It just came to my brain. Anatomy of an Epidemic. So anyways, it's really interesting stuff. And then I saw this fasting research. There's a great documentary about the long-term fasting from Russia that's on Amazon Prime, if available for streaming.
Called like Magic Bullet or Magic Pill or something like that?
Something like that, but it's good. It's really cool. So
yeah, anyway, I watched it.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah. Very cool. It's, I mean, if I had an extreme health issue right now, like, say cancer, for example, I'm definitely looking into those areas of study without question. I think that's the direction I'd go.
Yeah. And that, it is interesting. I mean, in the US we do that for some neurological issues like
epilepsy
and Parkinson's. The mm-hmm. first protocol we do for both, you know, demographics is a 3-day fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it makes sense, right? Because in that case, it's your nerves aren't taking out the trash. There's toxic overload. And you give it 3 days to kind of reset and actually dispose of everything. And then almost always their symptoms are lessened greatly in just those 3 days of fasting. There's lots of other really cool research coming out about extended fasts. Lots of different kinds of ways of doing it. It is pretty crazy. The longest fast I've done without anything is 3 days. And that wasn't fun.
That's just water?
That was just water. 3 days, just water. It's kind of, that's intense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, if I were, next time I do an extended fast, I'm doing it with some kinds of things that I could sip on. And
yeah, I've done bone broth for 3 days.
I've done a lemon honey one for 3 days.
Standard process cleanse?
Yeah.
What do they call that? Master cleanse?
Yeah, the master cleanse.
Well, it's honey, lemon, and cayenne and water.
And cayenne and water. Yeah, because the cayenne's to keep like your vessels open and dilated and everything.
Yeah.
That was less intense, but that was still pretty...
That's pretty intense.
It's pretty trippy.
But that's not a 3-day cleanse either. It's not designed to be 3 days.
Yeah. I did that for 3 days.
It's like 10 days or something.
Yeah.
All right.
And yeah, this is a long...
I don't really want to talk about these types of extreme cleanses. And I just wanted to tell you I was making bone broth because I enjoy it. It's not necessarily for the health thing, but like this will be a delicious broth for sure.
It sounds so good. I have to have pho this weekend just because of this conversation.
Everybody listening should, especially as the weather gets cooler. Delicious bowl broth. I mean, I'm saying that from Florida, and it won't be cold here ever. Yeah. We might have a cool day in like January or February, but definitely won't be cold here for a long time. And I still like to make the broth here because it is comforting and it's delicious, and I just like those flavors a lot. And Nick, it is an amazing thing. I'm basically making Jell-O because the extraction, especially from like the oxtail, so much collagen in there that it will be Jell-O when I put it in the fridge. It's amazing.
That's crazy.
And then when I want to rewarm, I have like a little tiny pot, like single serving, just throw it in there. It becomes this super rich broth as soon as it warms up. It's so good. All right.
What would it take for you to eat it in the cold gelatinous form?
Nothing. Curiosity. I've already done it.
It would take me a little bit. I'd have to work myself up to it a little bit.
Well, a lot of people don't realize when they have Jell-O, your instant Jell-O, it's just bone broth, kind of, with sugar flavor and coloring in it. But gelatin comes from like hooves and stuff like that. So there you go. You're having bone broth. Anyway. Oh, I can see Nick's wheels are turning. Nick's wheels are turning. He's like, wait a second. My whole childhood.
I was imagining, I was like, well, what if you did start to mark, you brought it to market where you did bone broth in the Jell-O form, right? You kept it on the shelf in like those Jell-O pack, you know, like those little containers that you pull the little wrapper off and then you eat it. But it's like savory bone broth Jell-O. Do you think there's a market for that?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's very niche.
Yeah.
But I think so. I think we could find some people, some suckers.
All right. That's our first cultivated being product.
Just a single serving bone broth, Jell-O packets.
To you. And it's good.
Well, that's kind of
ram wrap.
I hate to say it. But what is those like little bone broth, not bone broth, but those little like, forget what they call them. There's like broth cubes.
Oh yeah, that's true.
But it's not in Jell-O form. Actually, no, it is. I've seen it. It's not that popular in the U.S., but like I watch all the YouTube cooking things ever.
That's true.
And
I can vouch for that.
And a lot of like British chefs, some French, they have these like stock starter, but it's like Jell-O pudding or like those little Jell-O single cups, and it comes out looking like Jell-O, but it's really like dark, almost like black Jell-O. But that's what it is.
Yeah.
And so we have like little like condensed powders, or you have those like better than bouillon. Yeah.
I love that stuff.
The better than bouillon in the jar that's a little bit more liquidy, but it's like wet sand almost.
Yeah.
No, theirs looks like Jell-O, and they put it in for their stocks. Looks cool.
Nice.
But I don't see it on the market here, so maybe that's where we need to get it.
Yeah.
In the US. All right, Nick, speaking of the internet, I like to watch like top 10 stuff on YouTube, not going to lie. And I came across like a top 10, like dark age, like medical remedies that are like crazy. And so like some of them off the top of my head that I really like are, one of them's like, for toothache, you kiss a donkey, which is really good. For like pain in your body, you cover yourself in ox bile and poo and urine, and you sit really close to a fire, as close as you can handle it till it really burns you, and then you move away from the fire and the pain goes away. And then for headaches, chronic headaches, you just simply chisel into your forehead till you get past your bone, but not quite all the way to your brain, just that little soft, you know, tissue in between. Mm-hmm. And then you just let it heal naturally, and then your headaches are gone. Pretty good, right? Now this brings me to what I really want to talk about, which is the placebo effect, because it is like one of my favorite topics. It comes up time to time on this podcast, but we don't give it the proper attention. And if I was going to go to grad school to get like a PhD in something else, which I don't want to do at this point in my life, but it'd be something either studying consciousness or it'd be studying the placebo, because those are very two important things moving forward neurologically, that like answers that we don't currently have. And the placebo is just too important. And right now it is so vital to our society and we don't even realize it. So I've said this before on the podcast, like the most studied drug on the planet is the sugar pill, the placebo, because every drug in the US that goes to market has to compete against the sugar pill, and it has to beat it by a very small margin, mind you. That's science. If you can like beat the, like say you have this drug, you want to go to market to treat whatever, and it works 60% of the time, it has to beat the sugar pill. And the sugar pill is very effective across the board, better at some things than other things. But if you can't beat it by, I don't know, it's like 7% or something, then you can't, it doesn't go to market. But the point is, sugar pill is super good, and a lot of drugs don't go to market because they can't beat the sugar pill by a wide enough margin. And that needs to be explored, because here's the funny thing about it. Pharmaceutical companies 100% depend on the placebo effect. They're like the biggest fan in the world of the placebo effect, except when they're going to trial to try and get something cleared for market. That's the only time they root against the placebo effect. But the rest of the time, they're cheering for it because it makes their drug more effective.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? And as a chiropractor, I don't discount that either.
Yeah.
There's totally not a single treatment in the world, even surgeries, because they do like sham surgeries, stuff like that. Whether it's a drug, a surgery, a technique, a modality, the placebo is super important to your efficacy. And it doesn't make you quack. The future of medicine, I think, is going to be in like harnessing this effect. So here's what happened. We had the Dark Ages and everything before that. You had these wild remedies. And why would you chisel into your skull to get rid of a headache? Why would you do that?
Which, yeah. And you know, there were medical doctors at the time, but there weren't that many. And so most people who'd be performing these were was the barber, the town barber.
Yeah.
You can get a haircut or we can chisel into your skull kind of stuff.
Yep. And you do it because you had a certain belief. Like at that level, you would have to have a belief that it would help you. And all like accounts, obviously, data wasn't kept then like it is now, but by all accounts, like it did help people. Okay. And that's important to note. There's no scientific reason why it would, other than these people believed that it would, and therefore it did. And that's the thing, like placebo, like
kissing the donkey thing. That was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you have a toothache, kiss a donkey. I think it's amazing. And I think it's really important. So what happened though was this scientific revolution, like we had an enlightenment period, which is really to say a mechanistic enlightenment. Like we started to understand the machinery of the universe, right? Everything from how stars move and planets move to eventually to how like biochemistry works and eventually like organic chemistry. And we started to look at the machinery of things. And that led us to something that was really important because the placebo doesn't, I mean, it works pretty well across the board, but it works really well with pain. And we eventually found out how our pain receptors work, and we were able to mimic that, like our pain dampeners biochemically in our brain. Because let's get this straight. Your brain is a pharmacy. Your whole body is a walking pharmacy. And in your brain, you can make everything from serotonin, which makes you feel really good and kind of fulfilled, to dopamine, which is like pleasure centers, to cannabinoids, which is like what you'd get from, you know, smoking cannabis or marijuana or whatever, which also can make you feel good. It could be a mood enhancer. It could be like a pain dampener. And also opioids, which you naturally can make opioids. But what we discovered during this mechanistic period is that we can kind of mimic that. And the best one was morphine. Really powerful mimicker of our natural opioid like biochemistry that we can naturally make, which is awesome. That was a big breakthrough in medicine, and it's been incredibly helpful for a lot of people in dire situations. But that's kind of fast forward now to our modern time where I don't know all the stats, Nick, but what? Like the number one reason for disability or for like taking time off work is pain, right? Something like that.
Yep.
And I think it's like 1 in 4 Americans have some sort of chronic pain currently, which is crazy.
And the with the chronic pain thing too, I think that the next stat that comes after that is it's something like 70% of this chronic pain is recurring. So you have it at one point means you're likely to have it again at another point.
Right.
Yeah.
And so drug use, this is another thing. So 1 in 4 Americans have pain, which is important to note. But there's some stat, I actually looked this up. In the next 10 years, they expect 500,000 people to die of drug use.
Whoa.
And the opioids, like prescription opioids, and the ones that replace them when you can't get a prescription, right? So like the street drugs, that's the vast majority of the fatalities from drugs. And so 500,000, I mean, that's a lot more than guns by a long shot. And that's possibly even more than like automobiles in the next 10 years, because cars keep getting a little bit safer, I think. But anyway, that's a lot. So we have these problems, right? People dying of drug use and people in chronic pain. So we have like these two issues that one, they seem interconnected, but they're two very significant problems. And I mean, the answer in my mind is like, we have to have a new enlightenment period where we learn how to trick the brain way more effectively than by chiseling into your skull or kissing a donkey.
Yeah.
And there are some really cool studies out there. You want to talk about some?
Totally.
These are just to illustrate the placebo, okay? These aren't like, well, no, okay. I have one that's like an answer to it, so we'll save that. But I really like, this is a very simple illustration of the placebo, which is, or the nocebo, right? So the nocebo is the inverse of the placebo. So placebo is like, if you believe something's going to be beneficial, then... and your experience is beneficial, then, but there's no like scientific mechanism behind it. Or you could say reality or your experience doesn't match your, I don't know, actual reality. So experience doesn't match actual reality. So we could say, I don't know.
We get you.
I don't know how to describe that, but you get me. Mm-hmm. So the nocebo is if you believe something's going to be detrimental to you, and it is, even though there's no actual like mechanism behind that, then that's the nocebo effect. So this doctor out of the NIH, so the National Institute of Health, I don't remember I think it was a she, her name was like Kaloka or something like that.
Jake and I do not prepare this. This is all at the top of our brain right here.
Very simple test. Okay. So I'm going to just pretend it's you, Nick, getting this test done to you. So you're going to be hooked up to these electrodes and you're going to be looking at a screen. And when you see a green light, you get a nice little zap, a little tiny zap that you notice. It's not painful. It's just kind of like, oh, you get a little shock. And when you see a red light, you get a pretty good zap. Like you feel that in your whole body, okay? Like all the way down to your toes. So over the period of this, obviously you start to grow weary of the red light, right? Because it's a pretty good shock. But incrementally, she would increase the electricity you get on your green light. And by the end of this run, this trial, the shock's going to be equal. But it's not experienced to be equal. The entire time you're thinking red hurts really bad, green's not that bad. But by the end of it, they're the same. And not that the red gets less. The green just builds up to the red. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's kind of placebo in, and here's what it is. Because your brain is a really powerful predictor of the world. That's kind of what it's there for. So what happens is you take in the past, right? You analyze the past, you apply it to the present, and you predict the future, right? That's kind of how the brain works. And so it's really looking for, I guess you could say, patterns. It's like pattern recognition. And sometimes your reality doesn't match expectation. And for your brain, it's often easier to change reality then change your expectation, because expectation is like an ingrained pattern into your brain. Your brain's like, no, we know that this is how it works. And so it works kind of the opposite. So you burn your finger on the stove, you put it in cold water, and that cold water works your way from your finger all the way up your arm into your brainstem, into other like regions of the brain, eventually to your like frontal lobe, where it says like, that feels good and I feel relief. Okay. But placebo works the opposite. Your frontal lobe picks up that you had some stimulus that should be beneficial, and it works its way back down, releasing the same chemicals of relief, the same internal opioids, which are like different chemicals, like we call them like enkephalons and
endorphins.
And so it works backwards. It's just your frontal lobe picks up like, okay, this is a thing that's happening, and so this is what we should be experiencing. So where was I going with this? Kissing donkeys. So, okay. So here you go. You're getting this red light and this green light, and your expectation, the pattern recognition is red equals a big shock and green equals a little shock. And over a period, that's what the brain says. The brain's like, cool, we know what this is now. We don't even, like, we can just shortcut it. And it changes your actual reality, even though in all reality, those two shocks became exactly the same. The brain just says, this is what we believe it is, because it's looking for patterns. Pretty crazy, right?
It's really crazy.
So I want to talk about application of the placebo.
Let's do it. I actually want to talk about something like that too.
Okay. I really like this guy. So there's a doctor who works specifically with vets in chronic pain. I think his name is like Christopher Spivach. That's the best I can give you guys. Sorry. Maybe Google will help with that. But he works with vets and he works with chronic pain. And like the first thing he does with his patients isn't like, tell me about when you first started feeling the pain. He asks about their childhood. And he looks for really strong memories. So he looks for something sensory, like certain smells that they equate or certain tastes. Right? So I remember this one in the story. It's like, you know, someone remembers going to grandma's house periodically and getting these like Werther's Originals candies, you know, those hard candies that I haven't seen those in a while, but I remember those from childhood too. So we can all probably taste what like a Werther's Original tastes like.
Yeah.
So like a very strong memory sensory experience. And what he starts to do with these people, and these people are like vets that aren't, well, he treats all kinds of vets, but these are people that say been, you know, out of duty for 2 decades and have been on chronic painkillers for this whole time. Okay. So these aren't necessarily people like with new trauma. And so what he starts to do is when he gives them a drug, their opioid for pain, he also gives them that stimulus. So whether it's a smell or like a taste. So we'll give them the candy with the pain. And over time, he starts scaling back the drugs. And eventually just the stimulus, the sensory stimulus, is all they need for their pain management. Because the brain starts, it's like pattern recognition, right? So the brain's like, okay, this sensory experience means relief. And it releases the natural like endorphins. Pretty neat.
It's super neat. We, in my functional neurology classes, the professor showed us the pathway, basically the circuitry of pain. We just had to like memorize it and draw it out like a million times. It's at the level of the mesencephalon. So it's like all this frontal cortex kind of limbic stuff. Can actually, what we're saying here for people who are following, trying to follow, is your brain will literally send out natural morphines, right? The endorphins and kephalins onto that pain pathway. So it's not just like, you know, a great example of this is if you're talking to somebody who you really love, you're having a great conversation with somebody like Jake and I are right now, we're really connecting on not just a science level, but a bro level. Oh, yeah. Your pain seems to go away, right? And a lot of people think that's just because I am distracted from the pain, but no, your body in that moment is actually changing the biochemistry so that you are experiencing less pain. That's so cool.
That's nuts. And that's really important because like the stats are out there. 1 in 4 of the people listening to this podcast are in chronic pain.
Yeah.
I think this is really important too. Cause like you see a lot of healings out there and they come from different sources, right? They come from a procedure, a technique, a modality. They come from spiritual experiences. Okay. And they all got to be connected down at its root, which is like, and it's not superstition. It's really important to know. It's not a superstition. Like kissing a donkey is not superstitious. It's about belief. The brain's really powerful. And a lot of people, I think, suffer because they believe they should. Like, yeah. And I'm not just saying this is like clinical experience. I've worked with over 800 unique individuals, you know, thousands of sessions. And a lot of chronic suffering I see comes down from a deeper belief of that it's deserved. It's like paying for a crime, right? So you've bought into this idea that you're not a good person. So whatever shame or guilt pattern, right? Or whatever like pent up like resentment maybe towards your past self or any belief maybe you bought into from the external world, right? That you deserve this, you're no good, you're a piece of trash, whatever it is, playing in the background. And so either you're trying to like pay for your crimes with allowing this, or you've bought into the idea that it's deserved just because whatever abuse or suffering that you've been through. And when you have this glimpse of, no, I don't deserve this. And you get this like powerful, some people would refer to it as like anti-trauma or untrauma. Yeah. So trauma is this powerful emotional experience that can kind of change the course of your life. And any of those four health pillars you mentioned earlier, like this anti-trauma is opposite. It's a powerful emotional experience that changes a belief system and says like, you know what? I deserve to be well. I'm deeply loved, or I'm like deeply connected to my creator, right? To my God. And the physiology changes, right? Because there's countless examples out there of miraculous healings. It cannot be denied scientifically. It's just too many out there. So I think science needs to start exploring like, well, what's the healing, you know, what's the pathways here?
Yeah.
And how can we understand this better? So 1 in 4 people in America don't have to be in chronic pain, and 500,000 people don't have to die from substance abuse. Not just substance abuse, like these are like prescription, like opioid drugs.
Yeah.
500,000 people don't have to die.
A way bigger amount of being hurt and traumatized by abuse and other, you know, without dying, obviously.
Yeah. Just a lifetime of self-sabotage, just ways you're subverting your own well-being in your life without the fatality, without the mortality. So science needs to start exploring this inborn power to self-correct.
Yeah.
I think the placebo is maybe the most important thing like medicine needs to move towards. And I feel weird as a practitioner who's like planning on teaching future practitioners is like, hey, like I want to be scientific about this, but the placebo is scientific.
Yeah.
And part of your job is giving people that hope and like changing belief systems.
Yeah.
Because I think just as powerful as the nocebo is to create pain or to create a negative outcome, right? So you're not just like trying to give someone a placebo effect. You have to combat the nocebo. You're battling against that. And that's going to be more powerful than whatever maybe your technique, modality, or prescribed medication is. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, this is something that several months ago I decided that I was going to do this in my practice because of how powerful I know the placebo to be. People say in you know, business, right, marketing, whatever, they say you should always undersell and over-deliver. And that's always been my mentality is like, I'm not going to promise anything. I'm not going to make any promises. And then you're just going to be surprised. But now I know because of how important this is, I'm like, no, we're going to heal faster because of the placebo. And so I'm going to use this. And so a lot of times on day one with the person, I'm like trying to get them to be like, okay, this stuff in the past is past. We're starting a new chapter. Are you ready to move forward? are you ready to move forward with this to something else, to something different? And that, I think that's the most important question, because like you said, people are like, no, I'm not worthy. I don't deserve it. Or I deserve the punishment of it, the punishment that I'm experiencing. Or yeah. I'm afraid of moving forward. I'm afraid of what?
Yeah, because like, then what's my excuse in my life? I've had this crutch. This is why my life's the way it is. I've had this condition. And if you remove this condition, what's my excuse for where my life's at right now? Right. Yeah. So some people are afraid of that. So when people come to my office that I've seen a dozen different specialists in various fields, and they're like, no one has an answer for me and nothing's changing and this is the way it is. And some reason they're in my office because like a loved one says, like, you got to keep trying or something like that. Right. There's two questions I have to ask them. It's like, okay, tell me honestly, do you think you could be better? And the second question is, do you think you deserve it? And that gives almost all of them pause. It's just like, I'm not really sure about those things.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not asking them to get the answer there. I'm asking them because they need to look at themselves honestly.
Yeah.
And answer those two things. Do you think it's possible? And do you deserve it?
Yeah. And a lot of our, what we feel like we deserve is coming from a place of, you know, it is so weird because we're just so possessive of us, of ourself. I'm so possessive of this thing that I call me. It's mine. Like to a infantile narcissistic kind of way. Like when you see a kid and they have a toy and they weren't playing with the toy. Some other kid starts playing with the toy. They run over there and they're like, that's mine. They're willing to stake their entire everything on the fact that that's theirs. We're like that with us. And we think, you know, I think once we get people, I usually do this. If someone seems like they're not ready to give themselves permission, so to speak, to start healing, one thing I like to do is try to get them to start seeing themselves as not so much theirs, right? You didn't create your body. You didn't create like the circumstances of your life to right now. You are just a steward of this. Right. Mm-hmm. This isn't like, you can't take responsibility. Like you created this, right? You're just a steward, man. You're just there to take care of this. It's God's. God created you, you know? And if you kind of go, I mean, this is why it's kind of, I think, a really beautiful thing that scripture says, you know, you're a temple of the Holy Spirit, right? We look at this in a way to say, I am just caretaking for what is God's, and therefore I should take good care of it. And I should, you know, it's not about, you know, I don't know. You get what I'm saying. So I don't have to try to keep going into it, but that's sometimes is a step one for me with these people who feel a little stuck with that, and rightfully so. A lot of time. Yeah.
So
plays a huge role in all of this.
It does. So I'll say, if you're listening to this and you're like, this kind of feels like me, I have chronic pain, I've tried so many things, start with forgiveness. So start really making an inventory of maybe where you're holding on to unforgiveness. Maybe you're harboring some negativity. This could be towards yourself or towards others. And start working on that. Once you start letting go of those past negative experiences, freeze up your body. Like, it's like, I think of those when you hold on to some negativity from the past, I feel like you're tethering yourself to a moment. So if you feel like life is on a timeline, so you're moving like in a linear direction forward, when you hold on to a past experience, right? Unforgiveness is like, you know, that is number one way of like being attached to the past. You're tethering yourself. So you're making it challenging, exhausting to move forward. And it's keeping you from progressing. So let's work on forgiveness. And one of my favorite forgiveness exercises was created by Dr. M.T. Mortar Jr., a giant in the chiropractic world and honestly just in like the holistic healthcare world. And he did 5 steps. So if you got your pen and paper, this is what you do. first step, you forgive the other person involved, and we can do another exercise just for forgiving yourself. So we'll do that one after this. This is for forgiving another person or an institution or an organization or a collective, whatever. Okay. So first thing is you forgive the other party. Second step is you, in your own heart and in your own mind, give them permission to forgive you for whatever part you played, knowingly or unknowingly, right? Intentionally or unintentionally. And, you know, some people would make the argument like in a pure victim circumstance, some random violent crime, you're like, I played no part. And it's like, well, you don't know how everything works and you don't know whatever. So just do it. Give them, or like, you know, just give them permission to forgive you because you don't know everything. Nick, do you know everything? I don't really know that much at all. So yeah. So just surrender that part. Okay. Just give them permission to forgive you for whatever part you may have played. Third step, forgive yourself for any damage holding on to unforgiveness may have caused you in your life. Step four, figure out the lesson. What's the lesson in any bad situation? There's always something that can be learned and taken forward in your life and applied that's positive and beneficial. Okay. So what's the lesson? That's step four. Step five is be thankful and grateful for the lesson. And in this step, it's really important to really feel what that feels like in your body. So make that true. Okay. So you have a lesson. It benefits you. This past experience makes you a more complete or more realized human being. So what does gratitude feel like in your body from having this experience, this positive experience, right? And that changes you biochemically and it rewires your brain too from past, from like what that was for you into something more beneficial. And it's powerful. And that, like, I teach some of my clients this that are stuck in the past and their testimonies from just this exercise alone is very powerful.
Yeah.
And including my own life. It's very powerful.
Totally. And I would like to say I have been doing my gratitude exercises with all my patients, my clients. Just like Jake says, it's important to get to that feeling point. It isn't enough to go through, and a lot of people practice gratitudes and they just go through a list of stuff that they think that they should be grateful for. You know what I mean? Sure. And they're just like, I'm grateful for this. Okay, now on with my day. But it's like, it's important to get to that place of feeling. Like you have to like, oh yeah, I am grateful. I feel that.
This is important. Healing has never happened intellectually. You can read all the best like self-help healing books in the world. And if it just stays in your intellect, it's not going to change your life. It's got to be emotional.
Yeah. And this is why, I mean, so they talk about in your neurology, why did I start here? Sometimes I'm like, this is the most complicated place to get from point A to point B. Scratch that. Okay. This is neurological, but we're just going to use very understandable terms here. Repetition and intensity, right? That's what you can do. Any one of these tools that Jake and I give you, you have to use both of those things. Now, intensity are usually those aha moments. It's like you have a really intense moment of whatever the lesson's being learned. That's like, wow, aha, I get it now. And then usually in those aha moments, it's like, I was this way and now I'm this way and I probably won't go backwards. Sometimes people do, but that's like an intense moment, which you can try to create on your own, right? It's like, I'm going to try to really imagine, visualize, go there to my feelers and try to create an intense moment. That's kind of hard. It takes a little practice, but we can all do repetition because what happens with repetition is like we stimulate the neurology over and over and over and over and over again. And then that intense stuff becomes easier. It's just like all of a sudden that aha moment's going to happen. And it's like, yeah, like you could listen to a song 50 times. And then all of a sudden you get the song and you're like, how come? I was thinking about this with Matt Mark because I've been listening to his last album a million times. And I just
Echoes?
Yeah, Echoes. this has been out for a couple of years and I've heard all of the songs a million times. I know how to play all of them. I know the lyrics to the song. And then just this last week I was listening to one of them and it was just like, whoa, it like totally hit me, you know?
Oh yeah. There could be 20-year-old songs that just because the circumstances of my life, like I didn't connect to it, but then I've lived an emotion. And then that song, it's like, oh
yeah.
Whoa. That's this song. Yeah,
totally. And that's not a great analogy. It's not a perfect analogy, but that's what I'm trying to say with repetition and intensity. It's like you can have repetition and repetition primes the pathway. It's like more and more and more ready for it all to come together for you. So yeah,
that's the benefit of visualization. So a lot of these like mindfulness experts really stress visualization, right? You can start priming the neural pathways to expect certain outcomes by repeatedly feeling the experience of something that hasn't happened. So you visualize it, you feel what that would be like, and your neurology gets ready for it. And you start creating the conditions for it to happen.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. We can get into the science of that more. Maybe we should in another episode.
Yeah, we are out of time.
Sure are.
This is probably a long episode.
We don't know because it's longer for us because my computer kept having errors where it just kept cutting off and like closing the program. And so if you haven't noticed that, Nick did an amazing job of editing this. Yeah,
we'll see. But
you probably did notice it.
We had a moment where it looked like Jake was like, we should call this thing because
I was like, it crashed like 5 times. I'm just like, I don't know, Nick. Yeah. Not our day.
It doesn't bother me none.
You have to edit.
Yeah, it will bother me on Monday probably. But right now I'm feeling pretty good about life. Sweet. Okay. So cool. We're grateful to y'all. We're thankful. And yes. If you have any questions, any comments, please email us at thecultivatedbeing@gmail.com or reach out to us on Instagram at thecultivatedbeing.
Yeah, we had actually someone comment and she was concerned about our episode on the carnivore diet. And we should address that really quick, even though it's the end of a pod. Who's even listening at this point besides like our parents? She was concerned that feeding vegetables to her kids are killing her kids. And that is not at all what we were talking about.
Yeah.
So the talk
stuff, but I did.
I did send her the list and I told all the listeners, if you write in, I'd send you a list of like the highest nutrient to lowest anti-nutrient foods. But the point is, in normal circumstances, these anti-nutrients or like these somewhat toxic compounds in plants are beneficial. They make us stronger, more robust animals. But for people who are compromised in their ability to deal with toxins because of like a chronic health issue, then maybe more extreme dietary strategies might be valuable. But for the typical person, don't worry about eating plants. Your body can handle them. And those like little amount of toxins in those plants can have like positive effects.
Yeah. Sweet. If you are curious about anything else, if we said something and you want to know more about it, we'll hopefully I've posted some decent enough notes. I usually put some links in there if I'm like, yeah, this seems like this is something people want. And I discovered that not all platforms can open up if I just hyperlink it. So I put out the entire link so you could just copy and paste it if you can't get the hyperlink. Sorry, it doesn't look pretty. But
yeah, Nick, so thoughtful though.
Yeah. So that's what we're here for. We're here for something.
And hopefully. The hot spicy health tips. I think there's many in this. There's a recipe in there. There was forgiveness exercise. I think we really delivered today, Nick.
Yeah, over-delivered. We're going to have to charge people extra on this one.
We're still recording, right? I want to keep tooting our own horn, so.
Okay. Peace and love to y'all, and have a good one.
All right. Love you guys. Thank you.